I'm Valerie Earnshaw.
And I'm Carly Hill.
And this is Sex, Drugs, and Science. Today's conversation is with Seven Tomek, who recently earned her PhD at Arizona State University. So we're really excited to talk to you about, you know, all things Seven.
Very cool. There's this one time I did a thing called Vinyl Voices where I told a story and then I played a song on vinyl. And I started it out, I thought I was telling a joke, but no one thought it was funny. So I started out by saying like, "Hey guys, I'm Seven, I'm white trash," or something like that. And like nobody laughed. And then it got really uncomfortable for the whole rest of the thing. And I was like, "Sorry, but here's my song."
So do you want a redemption right now? Like, do you want this to be your redemption? Would you like to do like another, give us a one-liner right now? Yeah.
I was going to start out the same way. I'm like, "Hey, I'm Seven, I'm white trash." So I don't really think we do it.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's, yeah. I just don't learn my lesson. So
there you go. I like it.
It's a tough road. It's hard. It's hard to be me.
Well, you're also our first neuroscientist, speaking of your diverse identities. And so I am both excited and also like super nervous and intimidated to talk to you about your science. I was reading it this morning and I was like, how do we even have a degree in the same field? It's like reading Greek. I was like, I'm a psychologist, you're a psychologist. And it's just like totally different. Yeah.
I wrote it and I don't understand it either. No, that's not true. I'm just kidding.
I think that you do. Yeah. No, it's like I had to read it like with like the glossary, you know, like the dictionary open. But anyway, I was totally impressed doing our Google Scholar background, because I was like, when I left grad school, I had like one little baby paper, and you have like a very full, you know, robust CV. And you just graduated. I mean, you just defended your PhD a couple months ago. So I was super impressed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's awesome. I kept thinking if I just kept publishing and publishing and publishing, they'd let me leave. But they never really ever would let me leave. So.
Well, I think that's the problem when you're too good and when you're too useful, is that they try to keep you forever. So if you had been like me and a little less good, you'd be like, all right, you're ready to go.
I've met you. You're definitely very good. So. Yes.
Moderate.
I read a lot.
Yeah. So I was trying to wrap my head around some of the science pieces. So starting with, it looks like, so some of, you know, your research and the earlier research that you were doing within your lab suggests that opioids change people's social behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So they change how people interact with other people. So I thought we could ask you a little bit about that. So in what ways do opioids change people's interactions with other people?
Well, when I was at UNCW and really working with the human population, mm-hmm. a lot of people were struggling to restore relationships with family members, relationships with friends. And it was one of the major complaints in treatment. And we just didn't have any way to measure that in rats. And so what I tried to do was find a way to measure it in rats so that we could make drug research preclinically more translational to humans. And that was my ultimate goal. But the way I think it does change the behavior, aside from just what I've noticed, or if any of you, do either of you know any opioid addicts firsthand? Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see the changes from if you knew them before they used to now, like how they're just not the same person.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And some of those deficits aren't permanent. Research indicates that a lot of that recovers in 6 months, 3 months, depending, but some of these behaviors change forever. And mm-hmm. it's kind of like what fires together is like the neuroscience saying.
Okay.
So I was trying to find a way to change it. And there's a brain region that I think is responsible and implicated in this. And that's what I really focused on was it's called the insula. Mm-hmm. And it's the part of your brain that makes you decide that you want a sandwich or It's craving, it's emotion. There's a lot of emotional attachment to it. It's really been studied in taste aversion and like food aversions and stuff, but it's a huge part of drug addiction, but it's also where your empathy lies in your brain. It's where your mood states, your feelings. So it's all really intertwined.
So Seven, when you're talking about some of the things that, you know, you said, like some of the behaviors might go away while you're in, you know, this active using, and, you know, when you stop, some of these things come back in 3 to 6 months. What are some of the things, you know, when you said that some of the social behaviors that don't come back? What is it? What are some of those things?
Well, the behaviors that do come back, there's some evidence that certain parts of your brain kind of revascularize a little bit, or they show in like fMRI studies that they're shrunk. Some of those regain their normal volume, some normal functionality, but that's more based on like physiological, like looking at the brain regions. As far as behaviors, I don't know if you guys are familiar with a lot of stimulant studies, but there's actually evidence that people that have been recovered for a really, really long time still can't make wise cognitive choices. And so that part of their decision-making is flawed, seemingly permanently, which is pretty crazy. There's a task called the Wisconsin card sorting task. And there's cards that are good cards and bad cards. And it's like risk and reward. And they will keep picking the bad card even if they know better. Mm. And they can tell you, like, this is not a good card, but they can't stop themselves from making this choice. And that's kind of, they try to relate that to making bad choices in life. You know, like, you just can't do it. You can't make a good choice to save your life.
Yeah, so. Interesting.
So when I was doing some of my background reading, I mean, it looked like, from what I was reading, that drugs in general, or, you know, opioids specifically, mm-hmm. they impact the brain in a way that makes us feel euphoric and curbs pain. But then in addition to doing it, it just seems like there are these other actions or additional actions that are happening on the brain that might affect both, you know, behavior, but also other things.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so we have a very natural cycle in our brain of survival, of needing food, needing sex, needing water, needing all of these things. And what opioids do is they kind of trick your brain into thinking it's part of that loop of needing it to survive, that reward feedback loop. So when people really feel like they will die if they do not get their drugs, they really feel like they will die. I mean, it's part of that reward feedback loop. So it's really, it rewires the brain in a very compelling way that's hard to change.
I feel like there's so many different ways to study opioids, to study addiction. What made you decide to want to study it with rats, or to just study it in animal models, or focus on the brain?
Yeah, well, there are some really amazing clinical researchers that get to do like these huge clinical studies, but they're usually, they have a ton of money, they have a ton of accolades, and you can do all kinds of research at all kinds of universities, but it really boils down to you're handing out surveys, and then you're trying to extrapolate all this information from the survey. And there's no human that will let you drill into their brain voluntarily, even though they're doing really cool stuff in Europe right now that they are allowed to. I wrote a letter to the lady seeing if she'd let me help her, and she didn't write me back. So
yet. Yeah. Wait till she hears this. We'll send it to her.
Yeah.
So I did for my master's degree, I did a lot of human research looking more at like marijuana and other kind of behaviors, but it was just surveys. And it was hard to get the surveys passed through IRB, which blew my mind. It was really hard to do.
Yeah, we always go to, it's called full board review. So an IRB is like the ethical group that we have to tell that we're doing the study and describe it to them. And then they can either say, yes, this study, the benefits of the study outweigh the risks, or they might say, or they could say, no, the risks associated with the study don't. And when you're working with folks with substance use disorders or experiencing addiction, there's a lot of concerns over the risks that people associated with those surveys. So we also survey a lot of people and interview a lot of people, and we're typically go, you know, to the full board meetings, which essentially mean they're worried that it's more risky than than a lot of different type of survey research, especially. So yeah. Right.
Well, and there's also an interesting, so a lot of the people that do opioid research in humans, the way they have to do it, because you can't be drug naive, you have to have had some experience with opioids, or it's unethical to give you opioids. And there's all these other confounds that really make it hard to kind of look at causational relationships. So they still do a lot of really cool stuff with what they do, but when you take a rat and I have control over every part of its context of use, I have every part of everything else it's getting, you know, its food, its water intake, then I can more clearly see what's happening with what I'm trying to do. But there's a lot of, I was looking at clinical trials. There's a brand new, for depression, there's a brand new ketamine inhalant that's supposed to help with short or depression, but the depression that's been treatment resistant. Like, you can't just go get ketamine to like not be depressed anymore. You have to have tried everything.
Okay.
But what's crazy is when they do these clinical trials, they take people, put them on a brand new antidepressant that they've never had along with the ketamine, and then say the ketamine's 30% more effective on treatment. But it's, I have all these issues with, well, what about the new antidepressant you gave them? And what if that was, or all these other ones that they've tried that is going to have some long-term changes in their brain. Like, is this really an effective? It is an effective treatment, FYI. Mm-hmm. But the way they do the clinical trials, like, if I could just do it on rats, I'd feel better about
it. Right.
Yeah. And then I can connect their brains and see. You can like take mm-hmm. the brains out of their skulls and look at them under a microscope and see.
Okay. Well, I love that you're highlighting this, because one of the things that I tell to my undergrads when I teach a research methods class, and it's in human development and family sciences, so they're very much doing, you know, studies with humans. I'm like, studies with humans is really hard. it's risky. Yep. And it's challenging, and there's a lot of variables going on. And so anyone who tells you that, you know, studies with humans is easy is wrong. I mean, yeah. It's just, it can be really challenging for a lot of those reasons.
They yeah. never do what they're told. Actually, part of my
never do what they're told.
Ever. Part of my master's work with marijuana expectancy effects amongst undergrads is I didn't believe them. So I had an implicit measure and an explicit measure, because I was like, okay, this, I'm going to compare the two to see if y'all are lying. So
yeah.
And what'd you find?
There was like it became more of a study of the implicit measure than it did of the expectancy effects.
Okay.
But it was really, the implicit measures were able to predict more behaviors in like the IAT, which was really cool.
Mm.
I don't know. It gets into a whole other ball of wax, but
yeah, for sure.
I did find that females use marijuana more to de-stress, and men use it more to have a good time.
Okay. Well, ladies have a lot to be stressed about, maybe. So
the men that are trying to have a good time. I know.
Yeah. Full circle. Yeah. Mm. So you're in clinical psych then, and then you decide, okay, I want to go back and get a more of a neuroscience degree.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Kind of check all the boxes. And it really made my neuroscience research more translational, because a lot of people have no experience with humans.
Oh, okay.
Spend their entire careers looking at one single molecule or one like dopamine cascade. And mm-hmm. I feel like when you look at that in a whole organism, it's going to change, you know, whereas if I kind of look at things more as like a whole organism of behavior.
Yeah.
And that's the goal. That makes
total sense. Well, I was spending a good amount of time on IFL science today, looking at your like references to your past work. And it was really cool, because there was the one article that it looked like you had seen, right, describing this like paradigm with how to look at social behaviors with rats. And then there was a second article in which, you know, they were talking about how you saw that, thought, hey, let's add opioids, and then it was summarizing what you found.
Yeah, but it was so cool. I mean, that was actually the pinnacle of my excitement in academia, was that I effing love science, was like,
yes,
put my name in one of their articles. It was so cool.
No, that is so cool. Yeah, you could pretty much retire now. I mean,
yeah, I think, yeah, you've peaked. We're good now.
Yeah.
One of the things that my boss hated about me is I would find articles about everything and be like, let's add drugs. I mean, that was kind of my, like, I would send him text messages of, oh, look at this. This is what humans are doing. Let's add drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
It got annoying after a while, I'm sure.
Well, that's pretty much how I go through my life as like a stigma researcher. I'm like, oh, you know, over there, that's because of stigma, and that's because of stigma. And that, and then it just, it really ends up being a, you know, sad news bears lens to life. But I think that's how you know when like you're excited about something, that you, when you see it everywhere and you want to study it everywhere, like, I think that's how you know that you're onto something.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Actually, ever since I met you, every time I see something related, I was like, I say that stigma. I mean, I talk about like the ideas that we had to come up with for, you know, awareness and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've been talked about amongst the Phoenix area.
Oh, nice.
You're burning.
That's good. When I come, they'll be ready for me.
They'll be so ready.
So in that first article, it looked like in the first I effing love science article, it looked like the kind of paradigm they were working with was one rat in a tube. I'm like nervous I'm going to get this wrong. So there's one rat stuck in a tube, and then there's another rat, and that rat you train to get the other, the stuck rat out. Is that right?
We don't even train it.
It can figure it out.
When the tube is in distress, it figures out how to get it out. And it's crazy because it'll try all these different things and then eventually learn to flip the door open.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And after they learn faster and faster every day. So some rats never learn. Some rats never care. I guess it's a lot like humans, you know, we all help each other to a different degree.
Okay.
But there's some really cool, so the woman who invented this paradigm, she's at University of Chicago, and she found that a rat will save a rat it knows versus one it doesn't, and one that looks like them versus one that doesn't.
Huh.
This is really consistent with like bystander effect and stuff. And so the similarities are just bananas. I don't know. I think it's crazy.
Wow.
That is bananas. And then if I'm following the thread of the science correctly, you did exactly what you just said. You texted your boss and you're like, let's throw opioids on this, right?
Yep. But then we didn't have any of the equipment to do it because, opioids are heroin. I mean, that's usually what I use.
That's what you used.
Mm-hmm. Well, never personally, but
the rest. In the study.
Yes. Right. it's a very contextual drug. So part of the reason we have a lot of the knowledge that we have is like in Vietnam era, a bunch of vets did tons of drugs overseas. They came back, did way less and still overdosed, and people tried to figure out why this was. And it's very contextual. So where you are when you take the drug, who you're with when you take the drug, your body starts to have these autonomic responses when you start getting ready to take it. So environment matters. And if I had the rats save in a different environment, they do drugs, then it could change the motivations.
Oh, okay. So,
I called up my pops and I told my dad that he had to modify all these med PC boxes. They're the operant boxes you put the rats in.
Oh, okay.
And they cost like 80 grand for like 12 of them. It's ridiculous. And
wow.
So my pops, my South Dakota pops, he extended them all by like 40% so that the rat could self-administer drugs and save the rat in the same environment. And I'm pretty sure he stopped answering my phone calls after we did this project because it was like a ton of work. But he made it possible, so it was really cool.
Is he in the acknowledgement section of the article?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's amazing.
He's unbelievable. Because when I was thinking of ways to do it, I'm like, well, let's put like foil right here. I mean, it's just stupid stuff, but he made it really legit, you know, so it was cool.
That's awesome. What's his background that he was prepared to modify rat experiment boxes for you?
This is going to sound really, especially South Dakota of me, but he's a gunsmith, but he's like a mechanical genius.
Okay.
Mostly he's just this crazy old bearded man in the woods that builds shit.
And you said he gave you your name, right?
Yeah.
He gave you seven.
He's the hippie part of the hippie Catholic phenomenon that is me, so.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. So if I'm following the thread, then it's you are able to have the rat self-administer heroin in the box with the other rat that's in the tube. So how are they self-administering heroin? What does that look like?
Yeah. Well, first we do like baseline saving. So they rescue the rat every day for like 2 weeks.
Okay.
So that we can see if they'll do it, how long it takes them to do it.
Okay.
And then they self-administer heroin for 2 weeks. So they get a little port that we surgically put in their skin, and
okay.
It goes subcutaneously to their jugular vein. So I put a catheter in their jugular vein, and they nose poke, and the nose poke is like a infrared beam, and when their nose breaks the beam, they get an infusion of heroin, and
through
the heroin, and they love it. So don't be sad for them; they have the best time of their lives.
Okay,
and they get better medical care than most humans I know. Yeah,
right. Okay,
they have the best time. They party hard. And then after they're dependent on heroin, which is like a threshold of pressing or nose poking, some people have levers, we have nose pokes. Then I put them back in the chamber with their friend and with it hooked up to heroin. And then they have an hour to save their friend again. So either they save their friend, because they can do both. They don't have to pick. They could get some heroin and then open the door, or they could, you know, but they just, most of them don't. They don't, in the first study, none of them save their friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, they'd rather just hang out and do drugs and look at them.
So their little friend is distressed in the tube next to them, and their nose poking on the red infrared. Okay. Mm-hmm. Got it. That's pretty striking that overall, because it sounds like this is like a really well-used paradigm, and that these, you know, under standard conditions, the rats go save their little friends. I was reading somewhere, I don't know if this is true, but they were like, rats are even more helpful than humans. I don't know if that's true. But it just seemed remarkable that they could like figure out how to do it and then be super motivated to find their friends, and then to add heroin to the mix and they're just hanging out, not saving their friends. Okay.
So Peggy Mason found out, she's the one who invented the paradigm. She wasn't able to let animals self-administer, but she passively gave animals drugs, which is just giving them an injection. So she gave them an injection of a beta blocker and they still saved their friends. And then she gave rats an anxiolytic. I don't know which one it was, but they stopped saving their friends, but would still open the door for chocolate. So they wouldn't open the door for a conspecific, but would for a treat.
So what's an anxiolytic?
An anxiety medication.
Oh, okay.
So beta blockers still save. Anxiety meds, you're on your own, but I'll still get a treat.
Okay.
And you think about how many people, I mean, obviously this isn't a direct translation because there's a lot of work to be done, but aside from the individuals, you know, opioid users that we're talking about, but how many people are on anti-anxiety medications? You know, I mean, it's like...
Yeah, absolutely. So when you, I mean, you probably had hypothesized that this could be the case, right?
Yeah.
But were you surprised that in your first study, like zero of the rats helped their friends? That's really striking.
Yeah, I was. Well, and especially because there's kind of like mixed results with Peggy Mason stuff. But heroin is obviously a lot more reinforcing and rewarding than anti-anxiety medication or beta blockers are good once in a while, but not very rewarding. Different way. Long game. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's pretty crazy, but heroin's powerful.
Yeah. Okay. So then it looked like you were interested in trying to reverse it, right? So how did you start thinking about how can we turn around these effects?
Well, there's a researcher out of Columbia named Nasir Naqvi. Have you guys ever heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's a neurologist. I don't even know that he's a neuroscientist.
Okay.
He was working with human patients, and a lot of individuals that had strokes in their insula were no longer addicted to nicotine. Like just immediately no cravings, wasn't hard to quit, didn't have any side effects. And so he saw this correlation and he started to publish meta-analysis on it. And then that kind of took on a life. Other people started testing this theory. And so when I started reading his papers, because the insula is not really studied in addiction, there's been a pathway for the last 40 years that people have just been beating to death. And obviously we haven't cured addiction yet. So it's probably not exactly just that pathway, you know?
Right.
So I was really interested in the insula.
Okay.
And for me, for it to be involved in drug use and involved in social emotional behavior, it almost felt like I was making it up. Because
like it could be too good. Yeah.
There's no such place.
Right.
So that was exciting. So once this region became obvious that it was implicated in both things, I was trying to converge. That was the one. So
great.
Got to do some dreads.
Yeah. So what is that? Because when I was reading about it, I saw chemogenetic activation of this part of the brain. So what is that, the dreads part?
Yeah. So dreads. This is cool. I've actually been instructed, because I used to call it voodoo magic, and I'm not allowed to call it that anymore, but I am done with school, so I don't have any power over me.
Okay.
Right? Voodoo magic.
So it's a we take a virus. Mm-hmm. In this case, we took an AAV, which is a human adeno-associated virus. And on this virus, we pack all kinds of things. We pack a mutant receptor that doesn't react to anything else in the body. So there's nothing in your brain that could make this receptor fire. We put a promoter on this virus so that this mutant receptor goes into the right type of cell. And then we put a fluorescence so that you can see it in a microscope after we chop up the brain. And so I injected this directly into the insula on both sides of the rat and use an atlas for brain regions and stuff. And they heal up. It takes about 2 weeks for the virus to express in the brain. And then when I give them an injection of CNO, then all of the neurons will burst fire and they reconnect. So it's basically... you can inhibit neurons if you use a different type of virus, promoter. Like there's different types of mutant receptors. There's inhibitory, there's excitatory. So I use an excitatory one and it worked. So it was very cool.
So you're kind of like turning on parts of these brain, parts of the brain that when we looked at them in fMRI studies, which is kind of like taking a scan of the brain, those were kind of turned off before.
Right. And they're
kind of,
I mean, I didn't look at cell death. So in fact, when I've talked about this in a conference and I say, well, when that part of the brain is damaged due to drugs, then a lot of purists will be like, well, did you look and see if it was damaged? Do you know if it
okay.
was damaged? And I did not look at cell death or cytokines or anything like that. So to tell you that they were dead, but they stopped the behavior. And then once they were burst firing, the behavior for the most part resumed not to full levels, but way more than control. So it was still really exciting.
So the behavior, you inject this into the brain, things start firing, and then they start saving their friends again. Mm-hmm. That is pretty amazing.
100%, yeah. And it also really lent, because a lot of people are speculating that the insula is not really part of the addiction pathway or not that important in these processes. A lot of people say that this isn't a true measure of prosocial behavior or empathy in rats. And it's kind of like, well, if we're looking at just A plus B equals C, something's happening that's reversible. So I don't know. I felt pretty good about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's amazing that there's so much debate in the field, like that there's so much that we don't know, like that is really interesting. Because like I study stigma, right? And I feel like almost all of my papers are people experience more discrimination. They're treated worse by other people. That makes them depressed. And then they either don't take their medications or they use more substances or, you know, they feel some sort of bad or have some sort of bad health outcome. So it's like, it's really not like super debatable. Yeah. So it's really interesting that you're in this field where there's a lot of debate and speculation and it's really kind of like unsettled.
It's so open to interpretation. I mean, even when I first started talking about this and using the word empathy, and people got hung up on the word empathy. So I would start out talks by saying, asking the audience what they thought empathy meant. Mm. And whatever they all said, I'm like, yes, you're all correct. Now let's move on from that. Like, I don't care. It's not the point for me. The point is that we're measuring this behavior.
Okay.
Social, empathetic, however you want to call it, because there's huge papers just written on the beginnings of empathy and what it really means and looking at, you know, primate studies and stuff. And to me, it was just, a word that sums up helping somebody that's in distress or like, because emotional contagion is really what it is in animals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting. Hmm. So how would you think about translating this to humans?
Yeah.
What would that all look like?
Well, there's, initially I was thinking like kind of targeted medications. Like if we could,
okay.
The insula is really involved in, like I said, taste aversion and stuff is really what it's been studied. And so I was even thinking, like if I was going to go back and do more projects, which I don't even know if I'm allowed back there anymore, but if I did go back, it would be like maybe using like anti-nausea medications or different things and seeing if that changes any of the behaviors or restores any of these behaviors instead of the burst firing type stuff.
Okay.
And then maybe try it in humans with like, you know, pretests on empathy and prosocial after they've been in recovery as part of their treatment or something. And then try some of these, you know, anti-nausea medications or stuff with taste aversion and see if that changes their ratings would be interesting. But there's a person I mentioned her in passing in Europe who heads all these studies in Europe and Asia where they're actually putting a microchip in the nucleus accumbens, which is the big part of dopamine and addiction research.
Mm.
And it's kind of acting like that remote, you know, for changing, it's like deep brain stimulation, but it's portable. And it's
you
don't have to be hooked up to a machine and it costs like $100,000 to do it, but they're getting participants finally to try it for all kinds of Parkinson's, for addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be really cool to do it in the insula. I actually wrote to her and I said, I modulate the insula. Yeah. It's there. And but she, like I said, she never wrote me back.
Yeah. Yet.
Let's party. Yet.
But that would be really cool to actually try to modulate in a human for the purposes of what I'm trying to do with addiction.
Yeah.
Because based on the stroke stuff, like I still think that if the insula is completely taken out or like destroyed, that it they won't be addicted. So, and I tried to do this with lesions, but my first set of lesions went too far past and the other ones were too small.
Okay.
You know, it takes about 6 or 7 months of study. And after the second one, my committee was just like, okay, you can tap out. You're fine.
Do something else. Yeah. Or you can wrap it up with the data that you have, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I was really okay with the first data, but they wanted me to redo it. And then the second data was in complete opposite of the first data. And
oh, wow.
But the lesions were way, way smaller. Some of them, I couldn't even see them on the microscope. Like, I had to have people who were way better on the scope come look.
Okay.
So, but also, it's still consistent with the literature, because if the insula is destroyed, they're no longer addicted. But people with smaller insula or with lesioned insula have addiction problems and depression problems. And so, still fits.
So, if I'm getting this right, so this was your dissertation project.
Yeah.
And you were putting lesions in the rats' brains,
mm-hmm.
and then looking to see how that would affect addiction?
Both saving and their pressing. So I use the same paradigm,
but instead okay.
I put quinolinic acid into the insula.
Okay.
Just to, all it does is cause cell death in that region.
Got it.
But it was, my first acid ones went too far past the insula, and they reduced their, they slowed down. They still use ultimately the same amount, but they slowed down their intake compared to controls. And no difference in saving, but that makes sense because there's a floor effect with heroin, right? Like, if you're already not going to save with heroin, if you don't have a pro-social center, you're probably not, continue not to save kind of thing.
Okay, yeah.
I didn't want them to be using drugs anymore. So they used less at a less rate. But then when I did it again and made the lesions too small, where they didn't take out the whole insula, they actually increased their intake.
Okay.
Controls.
Interesting.
But it was a huge mess. I mean, it's not, it's so much, like there's a couple rats that used a ton. It was like, it's just not even useful. It was just, it was 2 years worth of work for nothing.
Well, that's, yeah, that's science. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you wrapped up the PhD. What's next for Seven?
I'm trying to find a job in the worst market in the world.
This is the worst market in the world.
It couldn't okay. be worse.
Oh, timing.
Yeah.
Timing. So Home Depot is like really cool. I might go work there and just write Doc on my apron.
Well, if you do go work at Home Depot, you're going to be able to construct the coolest rack boxes for your experiments ever.
Yeah.
When people come in for just garden parts, I'll be like, let's talk about the study you're going to do with it.
Yes.
I'll be like, I have an idea.
Let's do it. Well, okay, so we met at this training, Innovation Impact, and it was sort of designed to, hopefully none of them are listening to me butcher, you know, the description, but it was sort of designed to take folks who were doing research in these traditional academic centers and to push them into thinking about, like, taking different routes. So, you know, joining startups or small businesses and doing, you know, research in these different settings. So has that inspired you to sort of like think differently or to think broadly about what direction you want your research to go or your career to go?
Well, what I really want to do is, are you familiar with the medical science liaison?
A little bit, but tell us more.
I kind of feel like with all my little, okay, when I was trying to work in clinical, mm-hmm. I was seeing patients, I realized that I wasn't going to make a global impact. So then I'm like, well, maybe I'll go preclinically and I can make a more global impact. And that was also not true. So, and then I did the Yale thing and it's like, I have all these little pieces. Well, an MSL is somebody who, they're called key opinion leaders or thought leaders. And so you have a region and you talk to all the researchers, doctors, clinicians, practitioners, everybody, policymakers, and you kind of synthesize this information and take it back to pharma. So that they can come up with a new molecule or a new direction or make sure that the medications that you're representing are being utilized how they're supposed to be. And so this is, I've been trying like crazy to get an MSL job because most academics, most of them hate my guts because we'll go to conferences and in a nice way, and we'll go to conferences and there'll be somebody that they're really, really impressed with. And they'll talk to them about the one molecule they study, for example. And I will be talking to them about Alice Cooper and like this movie or this adventure or whatever. And then I end up getting job offers for postdocs or whatever, because I'm a social being, whereas a lot of people in academia just really aren't. Mm-hmm. And so the MSL role is really designed around being like cultivating relationships and maintaining them and talking about science. And those are my favorite things.
Yeah, you would definitely rock a job at the intersection of all of those things.
So I'm hoping he's really, really good.
Yeah, well, that's another good reason to get out of academia. Yeah.
Like, stupid, like it would be life changing. I would go from welfare to well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anything in the pharmaceutical company or in the pharmaceutical world. Well, it's interesting too, because I think like in academia, there's this idea that there's like, you're a good researcher if you're like in academia, and then it's like, it's bad. It's, or you're like going to the dark side if you go into industry or if you go into pharmaceuticals or something. And like, I'm never totally, I don't totally understand that. Maybe it's because like my body is dependent on pharmaceuticals to stay alive. Right. I take some pretty heavy like medications to be well. And so I'm like super grateful to the pharmaceuticals for that. But I mean, I do, having a background in the opioid epidemic, I also understand sort of the bad things that happen right. within pharmaceuticals. But
well, and that's one of the things too, like I would never be involved with sales or there's this rule book called the pharmacodes of even, for example, if there's a drug that it's on like the prescription for what it does, but then you know, based on all these studies that you've read, that it also reduces craving. You can't even tell the practitioner that you know it reduces craving. Like, they have to bring it up and then you can talk about it, but you can't even mention it because the rules are so strict, which is, I mean, it just shows that it's not like a shady, come take our drugs, we promise you the world kind of thing.
Right.
It's very super regulated, where you could go to jail if you say the wrong thing. It's, okay. It's pretty crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah.
But I want this job so bad. I don't care.
Well, let's get you there. But so, well, speaking of Alice Cooper, we did a deep dive on lots of your social media threads, and we saw this picture of you showing a brain to Alice Cooper, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us everything about this photo? Where were you? What was the makeup on your face about? What was the brain about?
Yeah, I tried so hard. My vanity tried so hard not to make that happen. Like, Patrick Warburton from Seinfeld was there, and the picture of me and Patrick Warburton, I look like the biggest dumbass because I got this.
Perfect. It was what you had to wear to whatever this event was, which yes. Hopefully we'll hear about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in our lab, we have a human brain in the refrigerator, and we have a few, but this woman was a woman who died in her 40s of alcoholism. So
wait, hold on. I thought you were going to tell me that this was a fake brain in the, no, this is a real person. Okay. I thought it was like one of those like foam brain. Like,
no, it was okay. So real. But I would tell them, I would tell, like, for example, Robbie Krieger from The Doors, like the best guitarist in the history of our mankind.
Yeah.
Looking at it. And I told him it's a real brain. And he's like, okay. And he holds it. And he's like, this feels real. And I'm like, I just told you. And he was like, and I was like, no, it's real.
How did that situation, though, I need, like, how,
yeah,
in
so wait,
what
did you,
world
like,
did that happen? Yeah.
Did you take the brain to, like, a concert or, like, an event? You're like, Alice Cooper's in town. Let me get my
brain. Is that like, you're
brain.
Like, I need phone, keys, wallet, brain.
I got my makeup done. Yeah. Got the brain.
I've done some pretty weird shit with that brain, but no, this actually wasn't even the weirdest. So one of my really good friends is Alice Cooper's photographer, like, photographs his family and his kids and his wife and, like, all of his, like, straight jacket stuff for School of Rock. Okay. And so he was doing this event, and it had a theme. And so she wanted me to come dressed as, like, a mad scientist. And I mentioned the brain, and he was like, yes, bring the brain. But okay. So up where they were doing the – because it was, like, a fundraiser. He has, like, this celebrity tournament. Up where he was doing photos with everyone, with all of his rock star friends. So people stood in line to get photos with him. And so I was hanging out by him with the brain, and then some people would come over, and I would teach them about addiction and the brain, and – so I got to hang out with all the rock stars. It was really cool. But I have, because all my friends are rock stars, like my closest friends have the craziest connections. When I think about, like, I'm one degree of separation from all these people I idolize, it like blows my mind. Like, I'm gonna see if I can find it. My friend Rachel is with like Johnny Depp in this one picture. And I'm just like, okay.
So I'm hearing that I'm now 2 degrees of separation from all. I significantly, by having this conversation right now, have really cut down my degrees of separation.
We're closer than Kevin Bacon. This is a big deal. But it was super fun because I'm a huge music fan, audiophile. Mm-hmm. The lead singer of Cheap Trick.
Yeah.
So yes, I knew he was in a band. I didn't recognize him, but I told him, because I love the music, but I just never knew what the lead singer looked like. And so I went up to him, and I'm like, I know you're in a band. I'm not sure which band. And he's like, oh, Cheap Trick. And he's like, I want you. He started singing it. And I was like, nice. Oh, good job on being good at music. And he's like, good job on being good at science. And I was like, okay, we're friends now.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it was really fun.
I don't mean to brag, but I did make Pete Townsend laugh once. So, ooh. I mean, I got that going for me. So you're now officially 1 degree of separation. Yeah, no, right. Yeah, like it's on my resume already. It's why Valerie hired me.
How'd you meet Pete Townsend?
Went to his book signing and made him laugh. Yeah, it was like a fan club thing. One of my dad's friends was a hooligan and got us into this private thing he did at the Museum of Anthropology in Philadelphia one night. And he played a private set for us, like just him on his guitar, and then signed all that stuff. Yeah, I was like number one though, and I made him laugh. And I didn't see a whole lot of other people make him laugh. Pete Townsend's not a funny guy, you know. So, yeah.
Anyway. Well done.
Thank you.
Did you finger guns him?
I love stuff like that.
You know what, Valerie? I probably did. I probably really did. Yeah, with the finger guns. Yep.
One of Carly's, I don't know what I would call it.
So the first time, now I'll make it quick. I was the underdog. I came back to school like after really essentially flunking out, and like Valerie was kind enough to take a shot, you know, with me being like my GPA like might not have even been one. Anyway, she has me in, and I you know am lucky to be involved with this like Sigma Lab, which is so cool, and like she's doing all the coolest things on campus. So I go into another professor's office hours, and I see Valerie there, Dr. Earnshaw at the time, who's in this, you know, this other professor's office, and I wasn't expecting to see her at all. And I'm not the most unawkward person in the world, so I see Valerie, the person who has just hired me for like the greatest opportunity of my life, and what do I say to her? I see her in the office, and I'm like, hey, friend, and give her finger guns. And was just like, why are you this way? Why are you this way? My second impression on Valerie was that I said, hey, friend, and shot her the finger guns. So
that's probably when you clinched it right there.
Probably.
That was.
Yeah. That's.
Yeah. And I was like, let's make a podcast in 3 years. Let's do this.
She saw your whole future flash before her eyes.
Yes,
it was
absolutely.
With the finger guns. Yeah.
It was with when I was finger gunned. Yeah, yep, absolutely. Yep. Well, that's interesting. So Carly identifies as a little bit of an underdog. I think of you, Seven, as a little bit of an underdog for academic settings. I mean, do you think of yourself that way also? Oh, or?
Fully. So I'm a single mom, a broke single mom of two kids. One's a kid and one's a wild animal. I don't know how I'm going to survive this quarantine. My son's 4 and his name is Bear, which didn't really think the long one on that one because he's a wild animal. But I started community college at 25. Don't remember even showing up to high school, but I know I graduated with like pre-algebra. So my eighth grader is now in like calculus or something. You know, it's just crazy. That,
okay.
That's how below. I mean, I think they finally just to get rid of me for high school was like take pre-algebra in summer and then you can go.
Okay.
I was challenged.
They're like, and launched.
Yeah.
Like, why were you not into school?
What's that?
Were you just not into it? Were you?
Yeah. It was just not a culture in my family. Like, okay. When a lot of kids were like looking to go to colleges, I was working at Taco John's, you know, okay. And I'm like, I'm good. Got a job. Yeah. Got a
car.
Got
this pre-calc or this pre-algebra under my belt. So.
Yeah. I'm set for life. So my daughter's father is an opioid addict. He's been incarcerated a bunch. He's been, but he's a trust fund opioid addict, which is the best kind because they could just keep coming back.
Okay.
So I was in a custody battle, and he's actually the last couple years he's been okay, but it's kind of cyclical.
Sure.
So we were in a custody battle. I didn't have electricity for months during my undergrad, and I'm sitting on the ground in a parking lot waiting for this court ordered family court psychologist to show up. And she pulls up in a vintage Jaguar. It was like forest green. And she gets out of the car and she's wearing like $1,500 shoes that I knew they were expensive because I watched Sex in the City at the time.
Malona Blahnik.
Like,
yep.
I was like, well, what am I doing? But part of it was too that at the time I was either going to be a psychologist or go into family law. And then I figured if the state paid for my education, it was like tricking them into paying my attorney's fees. So it was a very long, hardworking revenge plan.
Okay.
But
that is brilliant though. It is.
Wait, so that was college year. So you were in community college, but you got your degree from ASU, right?
Right.
Okay, so you transferred over.
And my community college professor, she came to my PhD party and I guest lecture at her course every like twice a semester. And so my first ever psych professor is still a million years later, like in my corner. It was like community college was the best thing I ever did. And then I turned out to be really good at school because I was really obnoxious. So like my lowest score was like 112% and I would argue it up to like the 115. So
okay.
It was obnoxious.
So what was it about? So was it, you landed in this psych class and you loved it? Is that how you like went down this psychology tunnel or what was it about that experience?
I think a lot of it is just how my brain works, where it didn't seem overly, I mean, until I got into like the molecular bio classes, the PhD level with no biology history, that I realized that maybe I made a terrible mistake.
Okay.
But a lot of it was pretty intuitive. And I started to feel, especially because, you know, that whole white trash dragging on my back, is that I was getting a lot of accolades and kind of, I was trying to make my identity more academically successful than broke single mom with two kids kind of thing. So a lot of it was perception formation and just trying to be, change my stars a little bit. So, and not be broke, which I took the really long game in that, because one of my good friends just became a PA. So she went to, she got her undergrad degree, and then she did a year of classwork and then a year of clinicals, and then she was making six figures. And then I still had like watch me go to school for more and be miserable. And this is awesome. And I make good choices.
Yeah. I remember I was, I graduated at the same time as my best friend from college. We were roommates. She's amazing. And she started going, working in retail. And, so at some point in graduate school, like, she moved into Philly. She moved into this like gorgeous high-rise apartment, like looking over the art museum. And I was like, I think maybe I took the wrong direction.
Right.
Yeah. It's definitely not, yeah, it's definitely not the direction to go for, you know, fame and money. But I feel like you don't know that when you're an undergrad. You don't know. I mean, it's so much education. And I think that there's also this thing that, people, like affluent people, go into it, right? Like wealthy people go into it. Wealthy people get their PhDs, and then they have like this family money. And then, so it just kind of perpetuates this, like, oh, academics have all this. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't know how to be broke. That's for sure. I'm like the Artful Dodger. I'm so good at being broke at this point that I still do. I mean, well, the seven economics that I alluded to, it's kind of, I can justify any poor spending behavior because I'm broke before and broke after. So at least I'm going to be broke with the experience. And so I just do my thing and it all works out one way or another. So
that's how I justify traveling too. I'm like, look, I'm going to be broke either way. But like, one of these situations leave me broke with experiences. So
yeah. Broke in Thailand.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
I spent a month in Israel with no plan and no money. Well, also Italy. And then I like slept in train stations and on bridges and but it was amazing and I had the best time. Yeah. I got buddy pass there because I used to be a pilot, or, okay, that's an exaggeration. I was getting my pilot's license.
Okay.
And so I got my 30 hours up until, like, you're supposed to do your solo flight at this point. And I was like, no, I'm not that good at this. I'm not going to do it by myself. So my flight instructor at the time went on to become a commercial pilot. And so he buddy passed me to all these different, weirdly, only I countries, like Italy, Ireland, and Israel, not on purpose. But so I went there with literally no money and just made it work. And it was awesome.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So fun. So, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you definitely feel like you break the mold, or at least the perceived mold for academics. So when you, did you feel like there's like space for you when you got to grad school, or when you know, in your master's program and your PhD, like, did you feel like you fit in those spaces with your background, or did you feel different in any way?
I mean, I'm the type of person who kind of just meshes in any scenario. I'm very adaptable, but any sort of incongruencies weren't really my background. It was more that I was a decade older than everybody.
And okay.
When I watched people acting like they were a decade, especially as a mom, and I was just like, no.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I live, you know, far from camp, because I bought my house before I even ever started school. And so I commute far, and I'd have to commute a lot. Like, when I'm running 6-hour heroin sessions, it's like I go put the heroin rats in and then get my kids ready for school and then go get the, like, commute back and forth, or sleep in the parking garage or whatever you got to do. And it's like, I just kind of ran in my own orbit at this point. And so some of my friends are actually more of the more faculty, older people in my age demographic. Really than my peers, just because I got to get the kids to school. And like, oh, I actually had a party once, invited people to my house. Well, no, I went to a, first preface this, I went to a party at someone's house and they were having a Harry Potter party, which was really, really cute. I like the idea, but, people were like slamming vodka. I mean, it was just like, it felt very much like, I guess what I thought college maybe would have been like had I been in my early 20s.
Sure.
And then I had a party, and I'm spinning vinyl, and I'm making, like, special cocktails that I looked up all these recipes, and it's just way different, you know? And classy, I was just like, yeah, it's a different mm-hmm. vibe. They're just not my tribe, you know?
Yeah.
Fair. Yeah. No, that is fair. I didn't even, you know, I just gave one of my PhD students like a pep talk the other day. I was like, because she just finished comps and now she's doing her proposal, like her dissertation proposal. And then yeah. she wants to put in a postdoc grant and then she's going to have to analyze the data. I hope she's not listening to this actually. Like, no, she's going to analyze that data and then she's going to defend it. And maybe she'll be on the job market. And I was like, and she had made this comment around like, yeah, one really stressful thing is done. And now I have to do the next really stressful big thing. And I was like, yeah, welcome to academia. But it is uniquely, I think, stressful and a lot in grad school, and to layer in two kids is a lot. So that would definitely set that grad school's experience apart a bit.
They're going to need a lot of therapy. I actually, there's a point where, like, and I'm qualified, but I still make them, no. There was a point where, because initially I started going to school for my daughter. Like, I wanted to give, you know, it was a big part of it. She was 3, I think. She's 15 okay. now. Three wow. when I started. And there became a point where I realized that I was doing it instead, you know, I kept saying I was doing it for my kids, but it was a detriment to my kid. You know, it was right. at their expense in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Even just when I'm just crabby and grumpy and like, you know, like trying to do something and my son keeps chucking pillows at my computer, you know, I mean, and just like, and this is how child abuse happens. Like, I get it.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like pretty much every household during COVID quarantine yeah. though, right now.
When they close the parks. Well, and now even, cause I take them walking like all the time and just try mm-hmm. to run them out, run his energy yeah. out. It's 100 degrees here now.
Yeah.
Oh so, gosh. Okay.
Yeah. This is not, it's not a thing. So and now you, I'm just going to.
You guys thinking. Are a couple of weeks behind us, right? So you guys like just started like full quarantine, right? I have a couple of cousins out there your way, and that's what they were saying to us, is that they were a few weeks behind us. So you're like, just getting in the thick of it, right?
Well, they haven't really made too many rules. So they did shut down like salons and stuff, but there's, I mean, I still go get all my takeout food and do everything. Like, there's not rules that you really have to stay home. It's just a suggestion. But they're actually opening things up again May 15th. So it's just kind of the Wild West where they just are like.
Yep. With the finger guns.
Like, you're on your own. Our governor has a lot of vested interest in a lot of businesses. Like, his wife owns blow dry bars and stuff. And so I have a feeling they're going to be opened up quick because he needs some money.
Money, right.
So it's very political.
That's fair. So do you, you've been in Arizona. Were you born? No, you weren't born and raised in Arizona.
No, I'm a South Dakota girl.
South Dakota. So how did you land in Arizona?
My parents drove me out here the middle of my, or beginning of my senior year, which okay. made me realize that as good as I thought I was at sports in South Dakota, I was in fact not that good at sports.
No. Okay. Play lacrosse.
It was a reality check, an ego check. I can't even imagine how big my head would be if I still lived in South Dakota, because I was like a baller okay. there. I was such a brat. Now I moved here, got an ego check, you know, just worked at Mobile and then okay. Home Depot. And then, I started community college at 25.
Okay.
Almost a decade later.
Do you hope to stay in Arizona?
I'll go anywhere I can get an MSL job. In fact, okay. There was one I was interviewing for, which was like Mississippi/Alabama.
Mm.
And I'm trying to give my daughter this pep talk that this could happen. And I was like, so look at these, how you can get like a 7-bedroom mansion for $150,000. Cause no yeah. one wants to live in Alabama.
Yep.
Totally. But,
I tried.
Well, we're going to have to get you this MSL job in Delaware. We need more 7 in this area of the country. That. Yeah.
I'll make sure that Scott, well, the guy from the Gym Blossoms, he'll come to you, and you can make him laugh too, because he's easy to make laugh.
Heck yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
Well, that'll be all Carly.
So do you pronounce, how do you pronounce your son's middle name?
Avid.
That's okay. That's a, yeah. So no, I was just saying, I'm a huge Avid Brothers fan, and I was listening to Talk on Indolence before this, that was, I pick a pump up jam before each podcast, but that one felt like the right one. Cause yeah. it's like, you know, we've all been stuck in our house for some time now doing all the things, you know, but anyway, that was one of the things. But that was to say that both the Avid Brothers and who was the other one you just said have just been to the Bob at UD. So if there's ever a reason to come up to Delaware, it's for the fantastic music scene we have in this little bubble right here.
Yeah, that's what Delaware is.
Yeah, I mean, like, science is cool and all, but like, more importantly, we did get the Avid Brothers to come to us. So
that's amazing. So yeah, my son is named after the Avid Brothers, as I'm sure you probably put it together.
Yeah.
They're so good. Have you heard, have you heard A Perfect Space?
Yes, I've heard of Perfect Space, but have you heard the Robbinsville Sessions?
I don't think
that's
I have.
The album. I'm going to email that to you after this. That's the one. We'll sort it out. I'll email you, but you have to listen to that. It's just like a live recording that they did of, it's like a whole album in its entirety, but it includes all the little like blurbs that they do in between each.
Yeah. And stuff like that is awesome. Well, so when Seth Avitt started cheating on his wife with the woman from Dexter.
Yep.
But whatever, they're still dreamy.
Yep.
And then I've been on a Smashing Pumpkins kick lately. Yeah. And, Billy Corgan looked at my story, and so I screenshotted that, and that's my newest new favorite thing.
Yes!
That is amazing.
I know. So we're basically, he doesn't know it yet, but we're on the way to be friends.
Right.
Yeah. And now we're one step away from Billy Corgan as well.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Like, I'll send you the screenshot. No, it was, Billy, the Smashing Pumpkins, like, I started listening to their discography from the beginning.
Yeah.
And Gage holds up. It's, like, very, like, grungy, like, because I was mostly melancholy in The Infinite Sadness and Siamese Dream.
Right.
But there's a moment in time right now for Gish.
Yeah, so that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah. That's fantastic. For the ears. Yes.
We're going to have a lot of back and forth email, I think. There's so many music things to say. That's what I was like talking with Valerie before we started. And I was just like, so I creeped real deep into Seven's Instagram.
I think all of our eyes did.
They really did. Yeah.
No. I was like, we're going to interview Dr. Seven Tomek. Here's her, you know, go look her up at ASU. Also check her Instagram page. And then they came back with like all sorts of questions about, because I think that you kind of like blew their mind about what a scientist looks like, but then specifically like what a neuroscientist looks like, because I think that they had this like older white man picture in their mind, and then they're like, how is this woman a neuroscientist, which was a pretty amazing, you know,
awesome
moment. Yeah,
I'm definitely old and white, but I'm not quite the main part, so
you're not old because we're the same age, so
man, when my daughter tells me I'm not cool anymore, I'm like, but I am. I'm so cool.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think we've got like a whole lab of RAs who would off on your coolness factors.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
I love your
sure.
lab. I'm definitely coming to, well, if I don't get a job, I'm going to do the stray cat thing and just show up. So.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Also, Delaware has tax-free shopping. I'm just saying, people can't wrap their minds around that, but like what it says on the price we pay, and there is no trick about it. Like, so I'm saying is that might be all you need to know to move up to Delaware.
I think I'm single-handedly keeping the economy alive with my poor like online choices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've been doing the Like It, Know It app on Instagram. And so I see shoes and you click on the shoes and then it shows you the link to buy the shoes. And I'm like, well, that's convenient.
Right.
Like, what are they trying to do to me?
Yeah. No, that's how I have tried both. What is it? The Rothy's and the shoes that are like slippers. I'll come back to them.
Oh, wait, the Vibrams? Are you talking about the toe shoes?
No, not
please
the toe
don't
shoes.
Tell me Crocs.
All right,
please
well, don't say oh, no, toe shoes with that kind of, you know, scornful tone there. It's simmer down, but.
Do you have toe shoes?
I did. Maybe.
Oh, that's a yes.
Maybe.
I did.
We don't know. There's no photo evidence. I don't know.
I can't even do like the toe socks, like just like the separation.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yes, those are so, they're like alien shoes.
Yeah, no.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're great if you don't have very high arches, guys.
We're learning so much about each other. This conversation really does also underscore for me what I should now recognize to be the biggest risk of doing this podcast, which is that Carly's going to realize how much cooler my colleagues are. And she's going to like quit and move across the country to Phoenix to go work with them. She's like, no problem. Let's study rats. I've got this. She's going to finger gun you. You're going to fall for it. It's going to be science. Well,
it's going to be a plot twist. Cause she's going to show up and I'll be like, well, I'm unemployed. So let's go to a rock show.
That's not a plot
like,
twist.
Thank
that
you
feels,
for everything.
Yeah, no, that feels, yeah. Unfortunately, I want to tell Valerie she's wrong. Cause I really do love my job, but it sounds like that actually is a pretty sweet gig.
So. I call it Seven's Canyon and Coffee Tour. So I'll show you all the red rocks, all the coffee and all the tequila.
I feel like the next podcast that I record with Carly or the next Zoom meeting we have, I'm gonna like see like Bear running across the background and be like, "Where are you?" She's like, maybe I'm in Arizona.
Or like the next podcast just begins with like, so this week's podcast should also be considered my 2-week notice. I live in Arizona now. That's what we do.
You can have Bear say it as Keeter coming from a kid. And he does like just repeat whatever you say, especially if it's a bad word.
Yes.
Yeah, that's for sure.
This is my effing last week.
Yeah. Before I knew that Tiger King was what Tiger King was, I thought it was going to be like, I didn't know it was just trashy documentary. I thought it was going to be about animals and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I put on the first episode and Bear learned some new words before I realized to shut it off. And
yep.
So he was saying those to everybody like, that we ran into contact with.
That bitch Carol Baskins. Yeah.
I guess it's good as quarantine time then.
Limit. Used them correctly. He's kind of
exposure.
He's like average intelligence, but he uses swear words correctly. So I'm really proud of that.
Good for him. Well, he is the son of a doctor now.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. Are your kids proud of you that you wrapped up? Like, do they understand? Like, well, you're no. Okay.
I think Azalea is feeling like a different weird kind of pressure. Cause I have her at a very, very hard school. Okay. When I was learning basic math from the beginning, like you have to test into math classes at community college. And I didn't know you had to do this. So I showed up and they're like, multiply and divide fractions. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that.
Sure. So, and now you have your PhD.
Yeah. And I had to learn all the math, but I had to learn from basic math and take a math every semester till I graduated. And
wow.
And so she's at a really hard, she's at like, it's one of the top 50 schools in the country. It was like top 10, but they changed the rating process.
Okay.
Because they were dominating the ratings, the basis schools. I don't know if you're familiar. And so she is like in eighth grade and she's taking physics and chemistry and calculus and all this stuff. And I think she hates me a little bit. And she's like, I don't want to be a doctor. And I'm like, you don't have to be. But this way, no matter what you do, it's in your brain. You can use it or not use it. She's a savant as an artist. She's an incredible artist. And she's more published than a lot of my peers. She's done the cover of textbooks, journals, international posters.
Wow.
And she started doing them when she was single digits, you know? Like, it's just crazy to think about. But she's probably going to be an artist in some way. But an artist that knows physics.
Which yeah. I went to an art high school that's number 2 in the state for science. So they're co-occurring.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
You guys can be a pretty dynamite team.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I'm going to go.
Pick one, find a job.
Yeah. Once you find a job, let me know. I'm joining you there.
Well, she might be able to speak to the fact that everyone else had pitch decks for this Yale thing. And mine was literally just a 10-minute or 2-minute plea for a job. At the very end, I was like, okay, if somebody hire me, that was like my last slide. Was like, and give me a job.
No, it's fantastic. The only reason it didn't work was because you were still a year out from graduating. My 2 minutes was like, and I don't think I'm going to do this. So I thought yours also went over much better than mine. You're like, I'll work with anybody here. And I was like, I think I came here and realized I am going a different direction. But actually what is cool is somebody from that project, I don't know if you remember Artin, the guy who was doing the PillSmart.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he reached out, and anyway, I was helping him a little bit with his application this week because he thinks that, I mean, it's actually a really smart idea. He thinks that he's created this pill dispenser, which is like a really sleek design. So adolescents who are using medications could use this dispenser and like no one would know. Like it's, you know, it's totally different to get out like your orange pill bottle as like a 13-year-old versus like this sleek thing that could be a cell phone or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was helping him figure out how he could like look at how that might reduce concerns around stigma. So it definitely has had an impact. I also came back from that and I made my whole lab do like a design day, which was so much fun. Like we covered the lab with like all sorts of like intervention ideas. So it got me thinking really differently about how to do science, even in the context of academia, and it established some cool connections.
That's awesome.
This one, but yeah. So, but it is cool because it could go a lot of different directions. But yeah, you pitched a job, and I pitched a. Oops.
You know who I'm still in touch with from that is Peter Loeb. Do you remember him? He's the Lions Rock guy whose daughter was addicted to opioids, and so he left Sega. He was a Sega Genesis VP. And then he went on to do Lions Rock. And
I do remember his presentation. I was thinking of the students. You kept in touch with one of the like the big deal presenters who came. Of course you did. That's awesome.
I actually have an idea to pitch him on a job for me too, but I'm waiting until the quarantine thing.
Okay.
He had there's a photo that I have where I'm holding like a vintage Gibson guitar.
Okay.
And he sent me a photo of him in the 80s. He was in like a rock band playing the same guitar I was holding.
Mm.
And then so we just, every time there's like new music, which I have a feeling is going to be our new thing. So
yeah, hoping so.
I want to teach a class at this record store by my house where I basically relate musicians from across generations. Like there's like Muddy Waters and Lead Belly, like Nirvana covered Lead Belly, and then bands that are influenced by Nirvana. And I kind of want to do this whole over the ages connection between all of them, or how like Radiohead got sued by the Hollies for their song, and then Lana Del Rey got sued by Radiohead, but then all these amazing songs of these musicians that I love. And so I want to kind of teach the background about the musicians, the connections, and then play it all on vinyl. And that's probably what I'm going to do instead of get a job.
One of my coworkers' sons goes to Harvard, and he's taking a class called From Bach to Beyonce right now. And she shared the playlist, like the Spotify. They didn't have to buy a textbook or anything. They just had to buy like a Spotify premium.
Spotify.
Yeah, like a subscription. And there's this podcast that like, and then your end, all you have to do is like, you have to listen to the whole thing, and then you have to make the connection between all of them. And they're like really funky, like not actually really, there's like, it's like druids. Yeah, it's wild, but
that's cool. See, that'd be right up my alley. I love shit like that. And I love when I hear songs that remind me of other songs, and then I'll find like an obscure article where they were somehow weirdly influenced on it because they were in the back of a bus in Melbourne and someone showed them the song or whatever. I love stuff like that. Like the stories, the whole VH1 Behind the Music was my jam back in the day.
Mm-hmm. That and pop-up video.
I learned so much.
Me too.
Well, I feel like you'd lose like the vinyl aspect of it, but I would totally read that book, like describe, like, you know, like tying all these people together. I think that'd be super interesting. And now that you've written a dissertation, I mean, you could probably pump that out in a week or two, right?
Well, I started writing my memoir to avoid writing my dissertation.
Okay.
It's called Get In, Bitches. We're going on an adventure.
Yes.
I love that. My memoir is called Inflamed When Immune Systems Attack.
Yeah.
Yours is better.
Yeah.
Get In, Bitches. I love that.
Yeah.
When does it come out?
Yeah. When I get a more interesting life, for sure.
I don't know how it gets more interesting.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. You've got wild animals in the house.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's my friend that takes photos, who's Alice Cooper's photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So she took a picture of me and her husband's van with the flames, and that's the cover of we said it looked like a novel cover, which is how it all started.
Yes.
And then when I was really avoiding writing, I started like the chapter outlines like a crazy person, but I'm probably not actually going to do it.
I would write about
rock stars.
Did you read Keith Richards' life? That's the name of his autobiography. You should do that. That was like, as someone that almost exclusively reads rock and roll autobiographies, read that one. It's the best one. It's so
good. I'll definitely read it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot of drug books lately, but really good drug books.
It's Keith Richards, so it's a drug book and an autobiography. It's both things at one time.
That actually is true. My education would fit two rock stars, so maybe I'll specialize in those next.
There you go.
There you go.
I'm never dating another one, but I will specialize in writing about them.
Fair enough.
Okay,
yeah.
Fair.
There's a book called How to Change Your Mind by Michael, what's his last name? His first name is Michael.
Will can look it up.
How to Change Your Mind. It's about like how all these labs started studying shrooms, hallucinogens. Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-E-N.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it's very educational, but written in a way that feels very
accessible.
Yeah, and like almost like you're reading a fiction book.
Mm,
you know,
okay.
It has that draw to it where you are really interested.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dreamland, which I think I was telling you about before, the Sam Quinones opioid book.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Really good.
Worth a read. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Seven, thank you so much for taking this time during quarantine time to chat with us. And I'm glad you were able to step away from the crazy animals in your household.
I thought my dog was going to make an appearance. Huxley! I'm actually shocked you didn't.
Yeah, I thought I saw you petting him.
Come here, Huxley.
Oh, this is great.
Oh,
first dog appearance on the podcast.
It is. And just so all the listeners know, Huxley is super handsome.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He's a little crazy, though, which we're struggling with because he's great with us, but strangers he's real weird with.
Yep.
Okay.
But he's from the pound.
Yep.
Had a hard life.
I have a Huxley, except for he doesn't have any white on his face. He has white on the chest, but otherwise they look exactly the same.
Yeah, he's as soon as I sit down on the couch, he thinks he's allowed to sit on my lap. Yeah. So I was shocked he didn't try.
It's like they need emotional support dogs. Like that's what I say about my dog all the time. Like you need an emotional support dog.
He's a stage 5 clinger for sure.
Yes, yes.
Oh man.
Perfect.
Man, well, we're all hands on deck on getting you a job, but only getting you a job in Delaware or Philly or Maryland. Yeah, I mean, you would take something at Hopkins, right? So
don't threaten me with a good time.
Yeah.
All right, a huge thanks to Seven for joining us for the podcast. It was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation.
I feel like Seven is just one of these people who has like sort of a gravitational pull to them, which I feel like I can say as someone with a PhD in social psychology that that's like a thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that out there.
I think she's effortlessly cool.
Effortlessly cool. Oh my gosh, she is.
Yeah, that should be her new tagline.
Yeah. And I think that that's just, you know, not always what you expect from a neuroscientist.
Nope.
Yeah. Well, we had part of the conversation with Seven was about economics. And I made a comment about how academics don't make a lot or something of those vein. And I think it's really important to temper that, especially at this moment of like huge economic instability. So. Yeah. What I would probably, you know, say if I could go back in time is that academics as a whole are super well off. And I feel very, 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 very lucky to work at a university, especially in the midst of COVID. In addition to that, I think that there is a lot more variability among, you know, jobs with people who have PhDs than I thought that there was before I got into grad school. So it wasn't until I got into grad school that I realized some things like how hard the job market was going to be after I left. I also didn't realize that there are a lot of, that there's a sizable number of people with PhDs who struggle financially, who struggle to get a job at a university or maybe in a research setting and kind of stitch together employment, doing maybe research contracts or teaching contracts with universities. So before I started grad school, I didn't realize that. And that is, that's, you know, something that sometimes tumbles around my mind when we talk about job earnings with people with PhDs.
I think especially, you know, with the title like neuroscientist. Like, oh, right. Man, yeah.
Yeah, she gets snatched up. Yeah, it's funny because we interviewed someone to join our lab the other week and she was saying that she sat through like a whole presentation in one of her classes from a professor telling her like, this is why you shouldn't get your PhD.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's because so many people with PhDs hit this moment in the when they're looking for jobs and they're really struggling to find a job and they worry about other people joining the field and having sort of a similar struggle. But overall, people with PhDs, you know, rocking it economically. So, you know, should definitely temper that conversation with that acknowledgement.
Set the record straight.
Set the record straight. Yeah. All right. So luckily, Seven has come to the rescue to get us out of this conversation about job insecurity and PhDs with a video. Let me pull it up and I'm going to hold it up to the screen and just tell the listeners what you're seeing.
What? Is that Scott from the Gin Blossoms?
It is Scott from the Gin Blossoms. Now just hold tight there. There is a full 30-second video coming at you. Ready?
Yes.
Are you buckled in?
Yes.
as usual. All right.
Hey, Carly and Val. It's Scott from the currently quarantined Gin Blossoms. And just wanted to say hello. And hope you are well. I think I'm well. I don't know. I'm waiting to get my antibody test back. But I wish that was a joke, too. But you know, and nowadays, you can never be too safe. So anyway, have a good summer.
Oh, that's the best thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life.
It's definitely the highlight of the whole pandemic.
The whole entire thing.
I have so many mixed feelings about this. Okay, A, I'm bummed that he had to get an antibody test. I hope that he's well.
Right.
So that's a, you know, hey, reminder that we're in pandemic. But B, Scott from the Gin Blossoms knows our names.
Yeah, and said them out loud.
And said them out loud.
On a video.
And it's recorded. We have proof.
Yep.
Amazing. And I have questions about whether we should be quitting our jobs and becoming roadies. Is roadies still like a thing for the Gin Blossoms?
Yeah, I also, what is the question? Because to me, there is no question. We're obviously going to go be roadies for the Gin Blossoms. Mm-hmm.
It's too bad if anyone actually is listening to this podcast that we're not going to be able to do it anymore because we are going to just be following the Gin Blossoms around.
But catch us on the next tour.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I mean, we pretty much have peaked for the podcast, for the career, for the life. So
yeah, no, it's only downhill from here.
Yeah.
But thank you, Scott.
Yes, and thank you, Seven, not only for talking to us and having such a great conversation, but also for, you know, sending us this video and making our whole COVID pandemic experience.
Yes.
Like the highlight.
Eternally grateful.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, thank you. Big thanks to the Stigma and Health Inequities Lab and the University of Delaware for their help with the podcast, including Natalie Brousseau, Alyssa Leung, and Sarah Lopez. A special thanks to Christina Holsapple, who researched this episode.
And as always, thanks to City Girl for the music.
And thanks to all of you for listening.